He could see himself on the cold stone floor, a little broken thing. But he wasn't broken now. He grabbed Hodor's longsword. The breathing was as loud as a blacksmith's bellows. From the well came a wail, a piercing creech that went through him like a knife. A huge black shape heaved itself up into the darkness and lurched toward the moonlight, and the fear rose up in Bran so thick that before he could even think of drawing Hodor's sword the way he'd meant to, he found himself back on the floor again, with Hodor roaring, "Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!" the way he had in the Lake Tower whenever the lightning flashed. But the thing that came in the night was screaming too, and thrashing wildly in the folds of Mira's net. Bran saw her spear dart out of the darkness to snap at it, and the thing staggered and fell, struggling with the net. The wailing was still coming from the well, even louder now. On the floor, the black thing flopped and fought, screeching, "No! No, don't! Please, don't!" Mira stood over him, the moonlight shining silver off the prongs of her frog spear. "Who are you?" she demanded.
"I'm Sam,"
the black thing sobbed.
"Sam! Sam, I'm Sam! Let me out! You stabbed me!"
He rolled through the puddle of moonlight, flailing and flopping in the tangles of Mira's net. Hodor was still shouting, "Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!" It was Jojen who fed the sticks to the fire and blew on them until the flames leapt up crackling. Then there was light, and Bran saw the pale, thin-faced girl by the lip of the well, all bundled up in furs and skins beneath an enormous black toque, trying to shush the screaming baby in her arms. The thing on the floor was pushing an arm through the net to reach his knife, but the loops wouldn't let him. He wasn't any monster beast, or even mad axe drenched in gore, only a big fat man dressed up in black wool, black fur, black leather, and black mail.
"He's a black brother," said Bran. "Mira, he's from the Night's Watch."
"Hodor!" Hodor squatted down on his haunches to peer at the man in the net.
"Hodor!"
he said again, hooting.
"The Night's Watch, yes!"
The fat man was still breathing like a bellows.
"I'm a brother of the Watch."
He had one cord under his chins, forcing his head up, and others digging deep into his cheeks.
"I'm a crow. Please let me out of this."
Bran was suddenly uncertain.
"Are you the three-eyed crow?"
"It can't be the three-eyed crow."
"I don't think so."
The fat man rolled his eyes, but there were only two of them.
"I'm only Sam. Samwell Tarly. Get me out. It's hurting me."
He began to struggle again. Mira made a disgusted sound.
"Stop flopping around. If you tear my net, I'll throw you back down the well. Just lie still, and I'll untangle you."
"Who are you?"
Jojen asked the girl with the baby.
"Gilly," she said, "for the Gilly Flower. He's Sam. We never meant to scare you."
She rocked her baby and murmured at it, and finally it stopped crying. Mira was untangling the fat brother. Jojen went to the well and peered down.
"Where did you come from?"
"From Craster's," the girl said. "Are you the one?"
Jojen turned to look at her.
"The one?"
"He said that Sam wasn't the one," she explained. "There was someone else, he said. The one he was sent to find."
"Who said?"
Bran demanded.
"Cold Hands," Gilly answered softly.
Mira peeled back one end of her net, and the fat man managed to sit up. He was shaking, Bran saw, and still struggling to catch his breath.
"He said there would be people," he huffed. "People in a castle. I didn't know you'd be right at the top of the steps, though. I didn't know you'd throw a net on me, or stab me in the stomach."
He touched his belly with a black-gloved hand.
Am I bleeding? I can't see.
It was just a poke to get you off your feet, said Mira. Here, let me have a look.
She went to one knee and felt around his navel.
You're wearing mail. I never got near your skin.
Well, it hurt all the same, Sam complained.
Are you really a brother of the Night's Watch? Bran asked. The fat man's chin jiggled when he nodded. His skin looked pale and saggy.
Only a steward, I took care of Lord Mormont's ravens.
For a moment he looked like he was going to cry.
I lost them at the fist, though. It was my fault. I got us lost, too. I couldn't even find the wall. It's 100 leagues long and 700 feet high, and I couldn't find it.
Well, you found it now, said Mira. Lift your rump off the ground. I want my net back.
How did you get through the wall?
Jojen demanded, as Sam struggled to his feet.
Does the well lead to an underground river? Is that where you came from? You're not even wet.
There's a gate, said Fat Sam, a hidden gate as old as the wall itself. The Black Gate, he called it.
The reeds exchanged a look.
We'll find this gate at the bottom of the well? Asked Jojen.
Sam shook his head.
You won't. I have to take you.
Why?
Mira demanded.
If there's a gate, you won't find it. If you did, it wouldn't open. Not for you. It's the Black Gate.
Sam plucked at the faded black wool of his sleeve.
Only a man of the Night's Watch can open it, he said. A sworn brother who has said his words.
He said, Jojen frowned, this Coldans?
That wasn't his true name, said Gilly, rocking. We only called him that, Sam and me. His hands were cold as ice, but he saved us from the dead men, him and his ravens, and he brought us here on his elk.
His elk? Said Bran, wonderstruck.
His elk, said Mira, startled.
His ravens, said Jojen.
Hodor, said Hodor.
Was he green? Bran wanted to know. Did he have antlers? The fat man was confused.
The elk?
Cold hands, Bran said impatiently. The green men ride on elks, old Nan used to say. Sometimes they have antlers, too.
He wasn't a green man. He wore blacks, like a brother of the watch, but he was pale as a white, with hands so cold that at first I was afraid. The whites have blue eyes, though, and they have tongues, or they've forgotten how to use them.
The fat man turned to Jojen.
He'll be waiting. We should go. Do you have anything warmer to wear? The Black Gate is cold. And the other side of the wall is even colder.
Why didn't he come with you?
Mira gestured toward Gilly and her babe.
They came with you, why not him? Why didn't you bring him through this black gate, too?
He can't.
Why not?
The wall. The wall is more than just ice and stone, he said. There are spells woven into it. Old ones and strong. He cannot pass beyond the wall.
It grew very quiet in the castle kitchen then. Bran could hear the soft crackle of the flames, the wind stirring the leaves in the night, the creak of the skinny weirwood reaching for the moon. Beyond the gates, the monsters live, and the giants, and the ghouls, he remembered old Nan saying. But they cannot pass so long as the wall stands strong. So go to sleep. My little Brandon, my baby boy, you needn't fear. There are no monsters here.
I am not the only one you are told to bring, Jojen Reed told Fat Sam in his stained and baggy blacks. He is.
Oh,
Sam looked down at him uncertainly. It might have been just then that he realized Bran was crippled.
I'm not strong enough to carry you.
Odor can carry me, Bran pointed at the basket. I'll ride in that, up on his back. Sam was staring at him.
You're Jon Snow's brother, the one who fell.
No, said Jojen, that boy is dead.
Don't tell, Bran warned, please.
Sam looked confused for a moment, but finally he said,
I can keep a secret. Gilly, too.
When he looked at her, the girl nodded.
John was my brother, too. He was the best friend I ever had. But he went off with Corrin Halfhand to scout the Frostfangs and never came back. We were waiting for him on the Fist when...
John's here, Bran said. Summer saw him. He was with some wildlings, but they killed a man, and John took his horse and escaped. I bet he went to Castle Black. Sam turned big eyes on Mira.
You're certain it was John? You saw him?
I'm Mira,
Mira said with a smile.
Summer is...
A shadow detached itself from the broken dome above and leapt down through the moonlight. Even with his injured leg, the wolf landed light and quiet as a snowfall. The girl Gilly made a frightened sound and clutched her babe so hard against her that he began to cry again.
He won't hurt you, Bran said. That's Summer.
John said you all had wolves.
Sam pulled off a glove.
I know, ghost.
He held out a shaky hand, the fingers white and soft and fat as little sausages. Summer padded closer, sniffed them, and gave the hand a lick. That was when Bran made up his mind.
We'll go with you.
All of you?
Sam seemed surprised by that. Mira ruffled Bran's hair.
He's our prince.
Summer circled the well, sniffing. He paused by the top step and looked back at Bran. He wants to go.
Will Gilly be safe if I leave her here till I come back?
Sam asked them.
She should be, said Mira. She's welcome to our fire.
Jojen said,
the castle is empty.
Gilly looked around.
Cresta used to tell us tales of castles, but I never knew they'd be so big.
It's only the kitchens. Bran wondered what she'd think when she saw Winterfell, if she ever did. It took them a few minutes to gather their things and hoist Bran into his wicker seat on Hodor's back. By the time they were ready to go, Gilly sat nursing her babe by the fire.
You'll come back for me, she said to Sam.
As soon as I can, he promised. Then we'll go somewhere warm.
When he heard that, part of Bran wondered what he was doing.
Will I ever go someplace warm again?
I'll go first. I know the way. Sam hesitated at the top. There's just so many steps.
He sighed before he started down. Jojen followed, then Summer, then Hodor with Bran riding on his back. Mira took the rear with her spear and net in hand. It was a long way down. The top of the well was bathed in moonlight, but it grew smaller and dimmer every time they went around. Their footsteps echoed off the damp stones, and the water sounds grew louder.
Should we have brought torches?
Jojen asked.
Your eyes will adjust, said Sam. Keep one hand on the wall, and you won't fall.
The well grew darker and colder with every turn. When Bran finally lifted his head around to look back up the shaft, the top of the well was no bigger than a half moon.
Hodor, Hodor whispered. Hodor, 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 Hodor,
the well whispered back. The water sounds were close, but when Bran peered down, he saw only blackness. A turn or two later, Sam stopped suddenly. He was a quarter of the way around the well from Bran and Hodor, and 6 feet farther down, yet Bran could barely see him. He could see the door, though. The Black Gate, Sam had called it. But it wasn't black at all. It was a white weirwood, and there was a face on it. A glow came from the wood, like milk and moonlight, so faint it scarcely seemed to touch anything beyond the door itself, not even Sam standing right before it. The face was old and pale, wrinkled and shrunken. It looks dead. Its mouth was closed, and its eyes. Its cheeks were sunken, its brow withered, its chin sagging.
If a man could live for 1,000 years and never die but just grow older, his face might come to look like that.
The door opened its eyes. They were white too, and blind. "Who are you?" the door asked, and the well whispered, "Who, who, 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 who,
who?" "I am the sword in the darkness," Samuel Tarly said. "I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers. I am the shield that guards the realms of men."
"Then pass," the door said. Its lips opened, wide, and wider still, until nothing at all remained but a great gaping mouth in a ring of wrinkles. Sam stepped aside and waved Jojen through ahead of him. Summer followed, sniffing as he went, and then it was Bran's turn. Hodor ducked, but not low enough. The door's upper lip brushed softly against the top of Bran's head, and a drop of water fell on him and ran slowly down his nose. It was strangely warm, and salty as a tear. Daenerys. Meereen was as large as Astabor and Yunkai combined. Like her sister cities, she was built of brick. But where Astabor had been red and Yunkai yellow, Meereen was made with bricks of many colors. Her walls were higher than Yunkai's and in better repair, studded with bastions and anchored by great defensive towers at every angle. Behind them, huge against the sky, could be seen the top of the Great Pyramid, a monstrous thing 800 feet tall with a towering bronze harpy at its top.
"The harpy is a craven thing,"
Dario Naharis said when he saw it.
"She has a woman's heart and a chicken's legs. Small wonder her sons hide behind their walls."
But the hero did not hide. He rode out the city gates, armored in scales of copper and jet, and mounted upon a white charger, whose striped pink and white barding matched the silk cloak flowing from the hero's shoulders. The lance he bore was 14 feet long, swirled in pink and white, and his hair was shaped and teased and lacquered into 2 great curling ram's horns. Back and forth he rode beneath the walls of multicolored bricks, challenging the besiegers to send a champion forth to meet him in single combat. Her blood riders were in such a fever to go meet him that they almost came to blows. "Blood of my blood," Danny told them, "all places here by me. This man is a buzzing fly, no more. Ignore him. He will soon be gone." Aego, Jogo, and Ricaro were brave warriors, but they were young and too valuable to risk. They kept her Khalasar together and were her best scouts, too.
"That was wisely done," Ser Jorah said as they watched from the front of her pavilion. "Let the fool ride back and forth and shout until his horse goes lame. He does us no harm."
"He does," Aston Whitebeard insisted. "Wars are not won with swords and spears alone, sir. Two hosts of equal strength may come together, but one will break and run, whilst the other stands. This hero builds courage in the hearts of his own men, and plants the seeds of doubt in ours."
Ser Jorah snorted. "And if our champion were to lose, what sort of seed would that plant?
A man who fears battle wins no victory, sir."
"But not speaking of battle, Marine's gates will not open if that fool falls. Why risk a life for naught? For honor, I would say."
"I've heard enough." Danny did not need their squabbling on top of all the other troubles that plagued her. Meereen posed dangers far more serious than one pink and white hero shouting insults, and she could not let herself be distracted. Her host numbered more than 80,000 after Yunkai, but fewer than a quarter of them were soldiers. The rest, well, Ser Jorah called them mouths with feet, and soon they would be starving.
The great masters of marine had withdrawn before Danny's advance, harvesting all they could and burning what they could not harvest. Scorched fields and poison wells had greeted her at every hand. Worst of all, they had nailed a slave child up on every milepost along the coast road from Yunkai. Nailed them up still living, with their entrails hanging out, and one arm always outstretched to point the way to Marine. Leading her van, Dario had given orders for the children to be taken down before Danny had to see them. But she had countermanded him as soon as she was told. "I will see them," she said. "I will see everyone, and count them, and look upon their faces, and I will remember." By the time they came to Marine, sitting on the salt coast beside her river, the count stood at 163. "I will have this city," Danny pledged to herself once more. The pink and white hero taunted the besiegers for an hour, mocking their manhood, mothers, wives, and gods. Marine's defenders cheered him on from the city walls. "His name is Uznak Zopal," Bran Ben Plum told her when he arrived at the war council. He was the new commander of the Second Sons, chosen by a vote of his fellow sellswords. "I was bodyguard to his uncle once, before I joined the Second Sons. The great masters. What a ripe lot of maggots. The women weren't so bad. That was worth your life to look at the wrong one the wrong way. I knew a man, Scarb. This Uznak cut his liver out. Claimed to be defending a lady's honour, he did. Said Scarb had raped her with his eyes. How'd you rape a wench with eyes, I ask you? But his uncle is the richest man in Marine, and his father commands the city guard, so I had to run like a rat before he killed me too." They watched Uznak Zopal dismount his white charger, undo his robes, pull out his manhood, and direct a stream of urine in the general direction of the olive grove, where Danny's gold pavilion stood amongst the burnt trees. He was still pissing when Dario Naharis rode up, arrack in hand.
"Shall I cut that off for you, eh? And stuff it down his mouth, your grace."
His gold tooth shone amidst the blue of his forked beard. "It's his city I want, not his meagre manhood." She was growing angry, however. "If I ignore this any longer, my own people will think me weak." Yet who could she send? She needed Dario as much as she did her blood riders. Without the flamboyant Tairoshi, she had no hold on the Stormcrows, many of whom had been followers of Prendelnar Gazin and Salor the Bald. High on the walls of Marine, the jeers had grown louder, and now hundreds of the defenders were taking their lead from the hero and pissing down through the ramparts to show their contempt for the besiegers. "They are pissing on slaves, to show how little they fear us," she thought. "They would never dare such a thing if it were a Dothraki Khalasar outside their gates."
"This challenge must be met," Arsten said again.
"It will be," Danny said, as the hero tucked his penis away again. "Tell Strong Belwas I have need of him." They found the huge brown eunuch sitting in the shade of her pavilion, eating a sausage. He finished it in 3 bites, wiped his greasy hands clean on his trousers, and sent Arsten Whitebeard to fetch him his steel. The aged squire honed Belwas's arrack every evening and rubbed it down with bright red oil. When Whitebeard brought the sword, Strong Belwas squinted down the edge, grunted, slid the blade back into its leather sheath, and tied the sword belt about his vast waist. Arsten had brought his shield as well, a round steel disc no larger than a pie plate, which the eunuch grasped with his offhand rather than strapping to his forearm in the manner of Westeros.
"Fine liver and onions, Whitebeard," Belwas said. "Not for now, for after. Killing makes Strong Belwas hungry."
He did not wait for a reply, but lumbered from the olive grove toward Uznak Zopal.
"Why that one, Khaleesi?" Ricaro demanded of her. "He is fat and stupid."
"Strong Belwas was a slave here in the fighting pits. If this highborn Uznak should fall to such,
The great masters will be shamed. While if he wins, well, it's a poor victory for one so noble, one that Marine can take no pride in. And unlike Ser Jorah, Dario, Bran Ben, and her three blood riders, the eunuch did not lead troops, plan battles, or give her counsel. He does nothing but eat and boast and bellow at Arstan. Belwas was a man she could most easily spare, and it was time she learned what sort of protector Magister Illyrio had sent her. A thrum of excitement went through the siege lines when Belwas was seen plodding toward the city, and from the walls and towers of Meereen came shouts and jeers. Uznag Zopal mounted up again and waited, his striped lance held upright. The charger tossed his head impatiently and pawed the sandy earth. As massive as he was, the eunuch looked small beside the hero and his horse.
"A chivalrous man would dismount," said Austin.
Uznag Zopal lowered his lance and charged. Belwas stopped, with legs spread wide. In one hand was his small round shield, in the other the curved arrack that Austin tended with such care. His great bronze stomach and sagging chest were bare above the yellow silk sash knotted about his waist, and he wore no armor but his studded leather vest, so absurdly small that it did not even cover his nipples. "We should have given him chainmail," Danny said, suddenly anxious.
"Mail would only slow him," said Ser Jorah.
"They wear no armor in the fighting pits. It's blood the crowds come to see." Dust flew from the hooves of the white charger. Uznag thundered towards strong Belwas, his striped cloak streaming from his shoulders. The whole city of Meereen seemed to be screaming him on. The besiegers' cheers seemed few and thin by comparison. Her unsullied stood in silent ranks, watching with stone faces. Belwas might have been made of stone as well. He stood in the horse's path, his vest stretched tight across his broad back. Uznak's lance was leveled at the center of his chest. Its bright steel point winked in the sunlight. "He's going to be impaled," she thought, as the eunuch spun sideways, and quick as the blink of an eye, the horseman was beyond him, wheeling, raising the lance. Belwas made no move to strike at him. The Meereenese on the wall screamed even louder. "What is he doing?" Danny demanded.
"Giving the mob a show," Ser Jorah said.
Uznag brought the horse around Belwas in a wide circle, then dug in with his spurs and charged again. Again Belwas waited, then spun and knocked the point of the lance aside. She could hear the eunuch's booming laughter echoing across the plain as the hero went past him. "The lance is too long," Ser Jorah said. "All Belwas needs do is avoid the point. Instead of trying to spit him so prettily, the fool should ride right over him." Uznag Zopal charged a third time, and now Danny could see plainly that he was riding past Belwas, the way a Westerosi knight might ride at an opponent in a tilt rather than at him, like a Dothraki riding down a foe. The flat level ground allowed the charger to get up a good speed, but it also made it easy for the eunuch to dodge the cumbersome 14-foot lance. Marine's pink and white hero tried to anticipate this time, and swung his lance sideways at the last second, to catch strong Belwas when he dodged, but the eunuch had anticipated too, and this time he dropped down instead of spinning sideways. The lance passed harmlessly over his head, and suddenly Belwas was rolling, and bringing the razor-sharp arrack around in a silver arc. They heard the charger scream as the blade bit into his legs, and then the horse was falling, the hero tumbling from the saddle. A sudden silence swept along the brick parapets of Meereen. Now it was Danny's people who were screaming and cheering. Uznag leapt clear of his horse, and managed to draw his sword before strong Belwas was on him. Steel sang against steel, too fast and furious for Danny to follow the blows. It could not have been a dozen heartbeats before Belwas's chest was awash in blood from a slice below his breast, and Uznag Zopal had an arrack planted right between his ram's horns.
The eunuch wrenched the blade loose and parted the hero's head from his body with three savage blows to the neck. He held it up high for the Marinese to see, then flung it toward the city gates and let it bounce and roll across the sand.
"So much for the hero of Marine," said Dario, laughing.
"A victory without meaning," Sir Jorah cautioned. "We will not win Marine by killing its defenders one at a time."
"No," Danny agreed, "but I'm pleased we killed this one."
The defenders on the walls began firing their crossbows at Belwas, but the bolts fell short or skittered harmlessly along the ground. The eunuch turned his back on the steel-tipped rein, lowered his trousers, squatted, and shat in the direction of the city. He wiped himself with Uznak's striped cloak and paused long enough to loot the hero's corpse and put the dying horse out of its agony before trudging back to the olive grove. The besiegers gave him a raucous welcome as soon as he reached the camp. A Dothraki hooted and screamed, and the Unsullied sent up a great clangor by banging their spears against their shields.
"Well done," Sir Jorah told him, and Bran Ben tossed the eunuch a ripe plum and said, "A sweet fruit for a sweet fight."
Even her Dothraki handmaids had words of praise.
"We would braid your hair and hang a bell in it, Strong Belwas," said Jiqui, "but you have no hair to braid."
"Strong Belwas needs no tinkly bells."
The eunuch ate Bran Ben's plum in four big bites and tossed aside the stone.
"Strong Belwas needs liver and onions."
"You shall have it," said Danny. "Strong Belwas is hurt." His stomach was red with the blood sheeting down from the meaty gash beneath his breasts.
"It is nothing. I let each man cut me once before I kill him."
He slapped his bloody belly.
"Count the cuts, and you will know how many Strong Belwas has slain."
But Danny had lost Khal Drogo to a similar wound, and she was not willing to let it go untreated. She sent Missandei to find a certain Yunkish freedman renowned for his skill in the healing arts. Belwas howled and complained, but Danny scolded him and called him a big bald baby until he let the healer staunch the wound with vinegar, sew it shut, and bind his chest with strips of linen soaked in fire wine. Only then did she lead her captains and commanders inside her pavilion for their council. "I must have this city," she told them, sitting cross-legged on a pile of cushions, her dragons all about her. Irian Jiqui poured wine. "Her granaries are full to bursting. There are figs and dates and olives growing on the terraces of her pyramids, and casks of saltfish and smoked meat buried in her cellars."
"And fat chests of gold, of silver, and gemstones as well," Dario reminded them. "Let us not forget the gemstones."
"I've had a look at the landward walls, and I see no point of weakness," said Sir Jorah Mormont. "Given time, we might be able to mine beneath a tower and make a breach, but what do we eat while we're digging? Our stores are all but exhausted." "No weakness in the landward walls?" said Danny. Marine stood on a jut of sand and stone, where the slow brown Skahazadan flowed into Slaver's Bay. The city's north wall ran along the riverbank, its west along the bay shore. "Does that mean we might attack from the river or the sea?"
"With three ships. We'll want to have Captain Grolio take a good look at the wall along the river, but unless it's crumbling, that's just a wetter way to die."
"What if we were to build siege towers? My brother Viserys told tales of such. I know they can be made."
"From wood, Your Grace," Sir Jorah said. "The slavers have burnt every tree within 20 leagues of here. Without wood, we have no trebuchets to smash the walls, no ladders to go over them, no siege towers, no turtles, and no rams. We can storm the gates with axes, to be sure, but—"
"Did you see them bronze heads above the gates?" asked Bran Ben Plum. "Rows of harpy heads with open mouths. The Marinese can squirt boiling oil out of their mouths and cook your axemen where they stand."
Dario Naharis gave Grey Worm a smile.
Perhaps the Unsullied should wield their axes. Boiling oil feels like no more than a warm bath to you, I have heard.
This is false.
Grey Worm did not return the smile.
These ones do not feel burns, as men do, yet such oil blinds and kills. The Unsullied do not fear to die, though. Give these ones rams, and we will batter down these gates or die in the attempt.
You would die, said Brown Ben. At Yunkai, when he took command of the Second Sons, he claimed to be the veteran of 100 battles. Though I will not say I fought bravely in all of them. There are old sellswords and bold sellswords, but no old bold sellswords. She saw that it was true. Danny sighed. I will not throw away unsullied lives, Grey Worm. Perhaps we can starve the city out. Sir Jorah looked unhappy. We'll starve long before they do, Your Grace. There's no food here, no fodder for our mules and horses. I do not like this river water either. Marine shits into the Skahasadan, but draws its drinking water from deep wells. Already we've had reports of sickness in the camps, fever and brown leg, and 3 cases of the bloody flux. There will be more if we remain. The slaves are weak from the march.
Freedmen, Danny corrected. They are slaves no longer.
Slave or free, they are hungry and they'll soon be sick. The city is better provisioned than we are, and can be resupplied by water. Your 3 ships are not enough to deny them access to both the river and the sea.
Then what do you advise, Sir Jorah?
You will not like it.
I would hear it all the same.
As you wish. I say, let this city be. You cannot free every slave in the world, Khaleesi. Your war is in Westeros.
I have not forgotten Westeros. Danny dreamt of it some nights, this fabled land that she had never seen. If I let Marine's old brick walls defeat me so easily, though, how will I ever take the great stone castles of Westeros?
As Aegon did, Sir Jorah said, with fire. By the time we reach the 7 kingdoms, your dragons will be grown, and we will have siege towers and trebuchets as well, all the things we lack here. But the way across the lands of the long summer is long and grueling, and there are dangers we cannot know. You stopped at Astapor to buy an army, not to start a war. Save your spears and swords for the 7 kingdoms, my queen. Leave Marine to the Myrinese, and march west for Pentos.
Defeated? Said Danny, bristling.
When cowards hide behind great walls, it is they who are defeated, Khaleesi, Kojogo said.
Her other blood riders concurred.
Blood of my blood, said Ricardo. When cowards hide and burn the food and fodder, great carls must seek for braver foes. This is known. It is known, Jiqui agreed as she poured.
Not to me. Dennis had great store by Sir Jorah's council, but to leave Marine untouched was more than she could stomach. She could not forget the children on their posts, the birds tearing at their entrails, their skinny arms pointing up the coast road. Sir Jorah, you say we have no food left. If I march west, how can I feed my freedmen?
You cannot. I'm sorry, Khaleesi. They must feed themselves, or starve. Many and more will die along the march, yes, that will be hard, but there is no way to save them. We need to put this scorched earth well behind us.
Danny had left a trail of corpses behind her when she crossed the Red Waste. It was a sight she never meant to see again.
No, she said, I will not march my people off to die.
My children?
There must be some way into this city. I know a way.
Bron Ben Plum stroked his speckled grey and white beard.
Sewers.
Sewers? What do you mean?
Great brick sewers empty into the Skahazadan, carrying the city's waste. They might be a way in, for a few. That was how I escaped Marine after Scarb lost his head.
Bron Ben made a face.
The smell has never left me. I dream of it some nights.
Sir Jorah looked dubious.
Easier to go out than in, it would seem to me.
These sewers empty into the river, you say? That would mean the mouths are right below the walls. And closed with iron grates, Brom Ben admitted. Though some have rusted through, else I would have drowned in shit. Once inside, it's a long, foul climb in pitch dark through a maze of brick where a man could lose himself forever. The filth is never lower than waist high and can rise above your head from the stains I saw on the walls. There's things down there, too, biggest rats you ever saw. And worse things, nasty.
Dario Naharis laughed.
As nasty as you, when you came crying out, eh? If any man were fool enough to try this, every slaver and marine would smell them the moment they emerged.
Bron Ben shrugged. Ergrace asked if there was a way in, so I told her. But Ben Plum isn't going down in them sores again, not for all the gold in the Seven Kingdoms. If there's others want to try it, though, they're welcome.
Ego, Jogo, and Grey Worm all tried to speak at once, but Danny raised her hand for silence. These sores do not sound promising. Grey Worm would lead his Unsullied down the sores if she commanded it, she knew. Her Blood Riders would do no less, but none of them were suited to the task. The Dothraki were horsemen, and the strength of the Unsullied was their discipline on the battlefield. Can I send men to die in the dark on such a slender hope?
I must think on this some more. Return to your duties.
Her captains bowed and left her with her handmaids and her dragons. But as Brown Ben was leaving, the Syrian spread his pale white wings and flapped lazily at his head. One of the wings buffeted the cell sword in his face. The white dragon landed awkwardly with one foot on the man's head and one on his shoulder, shrieked, and flew off again.
He likes you, Ben, said Danny.
And well he might, Brown Ben laughed. I have me a drop of the dragon blood myself, you know.
You?
Danny was startled. Plum was a creature of the Free Companies, an amiable mongrel. He had a broad brown face with a broken nose and a head of nappy grey hair, and his Dothraki mother had bequeathed him large brown almond-shaped eyes. He claimed to be part Bravasi, part Summon Islander, part Ebenese, part Kahorik, part Dothraki, part Dornish, and part Westerosi, but this was the first she had heard of Targaryen blood. She gave him a searching look and said, "How could that be?"
"Well," said Bron Ben, "there was some old plum in the Sunset Kingdoms who wed a dragon princess. My grandmama told me the tale. He lived in King Aegon's day."
"Which King Aegon?" Danny asked.
5 Aegons have ruled in Westeros. Her brother's son would have been the 6th, but the usurper's men had dashed his head against a wall.
5, were there? Well, that's a confusion. I could not give you a number, my queen. This old plum was a lord, though. Must have been a famous fellow in his day, the talk of all the land. The thing was, begging your royal pardon, he had himself a cock, 6 foot long.
The 3 bells in Danny's braid tinkled when she laughed.
You mean inches, I think.
Feet,
Brown Ben said firmly.
If it was inches, who'd want to talk about it now?
Your Grace.
Danny giggled like a little girl.
Did your grandmother claim she'd actually seen this prodigy?
That the old crone never did. She was half Ebenese and half Kahorik. Never been to Westeros. My grandfather must have told her. Some Dothraki killed him before I was born.
And where did your grandfather's knowledge come from?
One of them tales told of the tit, I'd guess.
Bron Ben shrugged.
That's all I know about Aegon the Unnumbered or old Lord Plum's mighty manhood, I fear. I'd best see to my sons.
Go do that, Danny told him.
When Bron Ben left, she lay back on her cushions. If you were grown, she told Drogon, scratching him between the horns, I'd fly you over the walls and melt that harpy down to slag. But it would be years before her dragons were large enough to ride. And when they are, who shall ride them? The dragon has 3 heads, but I have only 1. She thought of Dario. If ever there was a man
who could rape a woman with his eyes. To be sure, she was just as guilty. Danny found herself stealing looks at the Tairoshi when her captains came to council, and sometimes at night she remembered the way his gold tooth glittered when he smiled. That, and his eyes. His bright blue eyes. On the road from Yankai, Dario had brought her a flower or a sprig of some plant every evening when he made his report, to help her learn the land, he said. Wasp willow, dusky roses, wild mint, lady's lace, dagger leaf, broom, prickly ben, harpy's gold. He tried to spare me the sight of the dead children, too. He should not have done that, but he meant it kindly. And Dario Naharis made her laugh, which Sajara never did. Danny tried to imagine what it would be like if she allowed Dario to kiss her, the way Jara had kissed her on the ship. The thought was exciting and disturbing both at once. It's too great a risk. The Tairoshi sellsword was not a good man. No one needed to tell her that. Under the smiles and jests, he was dangerous, even cruel. Selor and Prendal had woken one morning as his partners. That very night, he'd given her their heads. Khal Drogo could be cruel as well, and there was never a man more dangerous. She had come to love him all the same. Could I love Dario? What would it mean if I took him into my bed? Would that make him one of the heads of the dragon? Sir Jorah would be angry, she knew, but he was the one who said she had to take two husbands. Perhaps I should marry them both and be done with it. But these were foolish thoughts. She had a city to take, and dreaming of kisses and some sellsword's bright blue eyes would not help her breach the walls of Meereen. I am the blood of the dragon, Danny reminded herself. Her thoughts were spinning in circles like a rat chasing its tail. Suddenly she could not stand the close confines of the pavilion another moment. I want to feel the wind on my face and smell the sea. Miss Sandy, she called, have my silver saddled, your own mount as well. The little scribe bowed.
As your grace commands, shall I summon your bloodliners to guard you?
We'll take Arstan. I do not mean to leave the camps. She had no enemies among her children, and the Earl Squire would not talk too much, as Belwas would, or look at her like Dario. The grove of burnt olive trees in which she raised her pavilion stood beside the sea, between the Dothraki camp and that of the Unsullied. When the horses had been saddled, Danny and her companions set out along the shoreline away from the city. Even so, she could feel Meereen at her back, mucking her. When she looked over one shoulder, there it stood, the afternoon sun blazing off the bronze harpy atop the Great Pyramid. Inside Meereen, the slavers would soon be reclining in their fringed tokars to feast on lamb and olives, unborn puppies, honeyed dormice, and other such delicacies, whilst outside her children went hungry. A sudden wild anger filled her. "I will bring you down," she swore. As they rode past the stakes and pits that surrounded the eunuch encampment, Danny could hear Grey Worm and his sergeants running one company through a series of drills with shield, short sword, and heavy spear. Another company was bathing in the sea, clad only in white linen breechclouts. The eunuchs were very clean, she had noticed. Some of her sellswords smelled as if they had not washed or changed their clothes since her father lost the Iron Throne, but the Unsullied bathed each evening, even if they'd marched all day. When no water was available, they cleansed themselves with sand the Dothraki way. The eunuchs knelt as she passed, raising clenched fists to their breasts. Danny returned the salute. The tide was coming in, and the surf foamed about the feet of her silver. She could see her ships standing out to sea. Balerion floated nearest, the great cog once known as Sardulian, her sails furled. Further out were the galleys Meraxes and Vagar, formerly Jozo's Prank and Summer Sun.
They were Magister Illyrio's ships, in truth, not hers at all. And yet she had given them new names with hardly a thought. Dragon names, and more. In old Valyria before the Doom, Balerion, Meraxes, and Vhagar had been gods. South of the ordered realm of stakes, pits, drills, and bathing eunuchs lay the encampments of her freedmen, a far noisier and more chaotic place. Danny had armed the former slaves as best she could with weapons from Astapor and Yunkai, and Ser Jorah had organized the fighting men into four strong companies, yet she saw no one drilling here. They passed a driftwood fire, where 100 people had gathered to roast the carcass of a horse. She could smell the meat and hear the fat sizzling as the spit boys turned, but the sight only made her frown. Children ran behind their horses, skipping and laughing. Instead of salutes, voices called to her on every side in a babble of tongues. Some of the freedmen greeted her as mother, whilst others begged for boons or favours. Some prayed for strange gods to bless her, and some asked her to bless them instead. She smiled at them, turning right and left, touching their hands when they raised them, letting those who knelt reach up to touch her stirrup or her leg. Many of the freedmen believed there was good fortune in her touch. "If it helps give them courage, let them touch me," she thought. "There are hard trials yet ahead." Danny had stopped to speak to a pregnant woman who wanted the mother of dragons to name her baby, when someone reached up and grabbed her left wrist. Turning, she glimpsed a tall, ragged man with a shaved head and a sunburnt face. "Not so hard," she started to say, but before she could finish, he'd yanked her bodily from the saddle. The ground came up and knocked the breath out of her as her silver whinnied and backed away. Stunned, Danny rolled to her side and pushed herself onto one elbow. And then she saw the sword. "There's that treacherous sow," he said. "I knew you'd come to get your feet kissed one day." His head was bald as a melon, his nose red and peeling, but she knew that voice and those pale green eyes. "I'm going to start by cutting off your tits." Danny was dimly aware of Missandei shouting for help. A freedman edged forward, but only a step. One quick slash, and he was on his knees, blood running down his face. Miro wiped his sword on his breeches. "Who's next?"
"I am."
Austin Whitebeard leapt from his horse and stood over her, the salt wind riffling through his snowy hair, both hands on his tall hardwood staff.
"Grandfather," Miro said, "run off before I break your stick in two and buggy you with—"
The old man fainted with one end of the staff, pulled it back, and whipped the other end about faster than Danny would have believed. The Titan's bastard staggered back into the surf, spitting blood and broken teeth from the ruin of his mouth. Whitebeard put Danny behind him. Miro slashed at his face. The old man jerked back, cat quick. The staff thumped Miro's ribs, sending him reeling. Austin splashed sideways, parried a looping cut, danced away from a second, checked a third mid-swing. The moves were so fast she could hardly follow. Missandei was pulling Danny to her feet when she heard a crack. She thought Arston's staff had snapped, until she saw the jagged bone jutting from Miro's calf. As he fell, the Titan's bastard twisted and lunged, sending his point straight at the old man's chest. Whitebeard swept the blade aside almost contemptuously and smashed the other end of his staff against the big man's temple. Miro went sprawling, blood bubbling from his mouth as the waves washed over him. A moment later, the freedman washed over him too, knives and stones and angry fists rising and falling in a frenzy. Danny turned away, sickened. She was more frightened now than when it had been happening. "He would have killed me."
"Your grace," Arston knelt, "I am an old man and shamed. He should never have gotten close enough to seize you. I was lax. I did not know him without his beard and hair."
"No more than I did." Danny took a deep breath to stop her shaking. "Enemies everywhere. Take me back to my tent, please." By the time Mormont arrived, she was huddled in her lion's pelt, drinking a cup of spice wine. "I had a look at the river wall," Sir Jorah started. "It's a few feet higher than the others and just as strong, and the Myrineers have a dozen fire hulks tied up beneath the ramparts." She cut him off. "You might have warned me that the Titan's bastard had escaped." He frowned. "I saw no need to frighten you, Your Grace. I have offered a reward for his head." "Pay it to Whitebeard. Miro has been with us all the way from Yunkai. He shaved his beard off and lost himself amongst the freedmen, waiting for a chance of vengeance. Arston killed him." Sir Jorah gave the old man a long look. "A squire with a stick slew Miro of Bravos? Is that the way of it?" "A stick," Danny confirmed, "but no longer a squire. Sir Jorah, it's my wish that Arston be knighted."
"No."
The loud refusal was surprise enough. Stranger still, it came from both men at once. Sir Jorah drew his sword. "The Titan's bastard was a nasty piece of work and good at killing. Who are you, old man?"
"A better knight than you, sir,"
Arston said coldly. "Knight?" Danny was confused. "You said you were a squire."
"I was, Your Grace."
He dropped to one knee.
"I squired for Lord Swan in my youth, and at Magister Illyria's behest I have served strong Belwas as well. But during the years between, I was a knight in Westeros. I have told you no lies, my queen, yet there are truths I have withheld, and for that, and all my other sins, I can only beg your forgiveness."
"What truths have you withheld?" Danny did not like this. "You will tell me, now." He bowed his head.
"At Kars, when you asked my name, I said I was called Arston. That much was true. Many men had called me by that name while Belros and I were making our way east to find you. But it's not my true name."
She was more confused than angry. "He has played me false, just as Jorah warned me. Yet he saved my life just now." Sir Jorah flushed red.
"Miro shaved his beard, but you grew one, didn't you? No wonder you look so bloody familiar."
"You know him?" Danny asked the exile knight. "Lost?"
"I saw him perhaps a dozen times, from afar most often, standing with his brothers or riding in some tourney, but every man in the Seven Kingdoms knew Barristan the Bold."
He laid the point of his sword against the old man's neck.
"Khaleesi, before you kneel, Sir Barristan Selmy, Lord Commander of the King's Guard, who betrayed your house to serve the usurper Robert Baratheon."
The old knight did not so much as blink.
"The crow calls the raven black, and you speak of betrayal?"
"Why are you here?" Danny demanded of him. "If Robert sent you to kill me, why did you save my life?" "He served the usurper. He betrayed Rhaegar's memory, and abandoned Viserys to live and die in exile. Yet if he wanted me dead, he need only have stood aside."
"I want the whole truth now, on your honour as a knight. Are you the usurper's man or mine?" "Yours, if you will have me."
Sir Barristan had tears in his eyes.
"I took Robert's pardon, I served him in Kingsguard and Council. Served with the Kingslayer, and others near as bad, who soiled the white cloak I wore. Nothing will excuse that. I might be serving in King's Landing still, if the vile boy upon the Iron Throne had not cast me aside. It shames me to admit. But when he took the cloak that the White Bull had draped about my shoulders, and sent men to kill me that selfsame day, it was as though he dripped a caul off my eyes. That was when I knew I must find my true king and die in his service."
"I can grant that wish," Sir Jorah said darkly.
"Quiet,"
said Danny. "I'll hear him out."
"It may be that I must die a traitor's death," Sir Barristan said. "If so, I should not die alone. Before I took Robert's pardon, I fought against him on the Trident. You were on the other side of that battle moment, were you not? He did not wait for an answer. Your Grace, I'm sorry I misled you.